animal. Talks like an animal. Must be an animal. Come hear the animal. Talking animal. Talking animal.
Good morning. This is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss, and of course, in observance of the stay-at-home order, we're doing another split location show. I'm speaking to you from my house in Jupiter Farm. And in studio at WMNF is my friend and WMNF's music director, Flea. Good morning, Flea.
Arr, arr.
So let's have a quick chat, Flea. So, because, again, some people may not know that are Talking Animals listeners, that you're quite an animal guy yourself. So, for example, when did you and your wife start fostering?
Oh, geez, it's been about 10 years ago, I think, we started fostering. I don't know, when did you get Daisy?
Well, yeah, it was about 10-plus years ago. So was Daisy one of your first fosters?
Yes, our first foster.
Very first?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, I knew it was an early one. I didn't realize it was the very first. So I should let listeners know that the Daisy we're referring to, because, of course, there's millions and millions of dogs named Daisy, including ours. But, our lovely yellow lab was fostered by Flea and his wife, Lauren, and she is a great, great dog, and I attribute at least some of that, if not all of that, to the great fostering experience and being in a great household before the Daisy came to our household. So, and you still foster now, Flea?
Yeah, we do. We still foster. A dog every now and then.
Yeah, all right. Well, we'll have our little Flea moment, hopefully, as we do these shows ongoing, as long as the stay-at-home order stays where it is. So we'll find out more about your experience with fostering and puppy raising and all kinds of other stuff, including a new dog in the household. But we don't want to cover every single one of those things today, but we've got to parcel them out over the next few shows.
Tales of Poop and Pee.
Okay. Well, that's a beautiful subtitle. I like it. I'm jotting that down now. Anyway, with Flea's production assistance, I'll deliver a version of Talking Animals today, offering a pretty full dance card, including playing back two interviews I recorded in recent days. The first, which we'll hear in just a moment, is with Susan Fleming, a writer, producer, director, who's been making movies for 30 years and specializing in nature films for 20. Her latest documentary, Remarkable Rabbits, a fascinating foray into the world of rabbits and hares, airs tonight on your local PBS station as part of the series Nature. Remarkable Rabbits spotlights various breeds of rabbits from various parts of the country, including in the South, the swamp rabbit, which has a surprising ability, which we'll touch on with Susan, no spoilers just yet, the New England cottontail, whose population has dwindled dramatically, and we see measures seeking to restore that population. Striking footage of eastern cottontails mating, yes, you heard me, and a glimpse at a major rabbit show that, as I note to Fleming, the Westminster Dog Show has nothing on this collection of people and animals. So we'll hear that interview in just a moment here on Talking Animals on WMNF. Later in the show, I'll air an interview I recorded recently with Rhonda Eldridge, the president of Community Pet Project, which provides pet food to homeless and at-risk communities in Hillsborough County, and has significantly broadened its effort in the wake of the expanding impact of the coronavirus. Eldridge and her battalion of fellow volunteers are offering pet food and other products and accessories, even helping with veterinary bills for a growing number of individuals and families who are having a tougher time keeping their animals fed and in good care. So we'll hear about Community Pets Project history, mission, and how things have changed in this COVID-19 era. Right now, though, let's play back the interview with Susan Fleming about her new film, Remarkable Rabbits, which airs tonight on the PBS series Nature. Recorded Friday, this is Susan Fleming on Talking Animals.
So before we get into Remarkable Rabbits, and the alliteration is just one of the film's many virtues, let's explore a bit of the Susan Fleming story. So folks who make nature films tend to have a particular origin story going back to childhood. They loved being outdoors and felt a powerful kinship with animals and other critters. How closely does that description apply to you?
Oh, to a T. I was a kid who came home from school and climbed a tree and ate my lunch every day just so I could see everything from a bird's perspective. And, you know, every weekend was took my bucket and my peanut butter sandwich and went out hunting for bugs and trying to, you know, just see nature and be in nature. And it's continued to this day. I live on a farm way out in the countryside about an hour and a half north of Toronto, and I'm surrounded by wildlife, and I have horses, and the passion continues.
Well, that's also, I think, part of the general pattern, it seems like, is that people who do make nature films, that usually does hold true well beyond childhood into adulthood, and it sounds like, again, you're fitting that pattern right down to the last horse observational.
It has to be a lifestyle. This is that when I try to explain to people what my job is, they kind of just shake their head because, you know, you're living in a blind in the middle of a forest up in Yukon as the bears are waking up trying to get the, you know, the first footage of them coming out from hibernation, and you're there literally peeing in a cup and eating peanut butter sandwiches for 3 weeks. And they think, that, oh my God, that's what you do? And it's like, yeah, aren't I lucky?
Yeah. So, right. Well, that's the thing. It is a particular lifestyle, and yeah, it does seem, once again, to have its roots in being a kid who, yeah, came home from school and did exactly what you did, and all these years later, some of the details of what you're doing are changing a little bit, but the fundamental ones remain. So how did you convert that, what we now established as a pretty long-standing passion, into filmmaking? What were your first jobs in that world?
I started out making documentaries. I went to journalism school and then film school, and I started out making documentaries about people. And I found that it wasn't what kind of fascinated me. What fascinated me was the natural world. And interesting people have agendas, and they tell you what they want you to hear.
Yeah.
And animals don't do that. They just show their true selves. So I kind of got tired of trying to figure out what people's agenda was and decided I just want to focus on things that are completely true. And once I moved over to making nature films, I just felt like I'd really found my world. It was where I wanted to be in terms of spending my time, but it was also just the truth of nature in all its glory and fierceness. And it's just honestly what it is. Animals are what they are. And there's something really refreshing about being immersed in that. And being immersed in the now, like you have to live in the moment to be a nature filmmaker, because things can change in the blink of an eye, and you have to always just be living in the moment and watching, and you can't control anything. You have to just let it happen. It's both a freeing and an amazingly enlivening experience.
And it also sounds like, well, you did venture into documentaries about people. Any figures or items or companies, anything that you want to mention that while you were still in that?
No, now it's been a long time.
Yeah,
I've
okay.
been completely dedicated to nature films for 20 years.
Yeah.
And I've been a filmmaker for 30, so it's kind of, it's a crazy thing to be doing something this long. But honestly, I still feel like the luckiest duck alive that I get to do this. So well, I think I picked the right thing.
Right, and of course there's an animal reference right there, so that just underscores our point. But also it sounds like, too, that after going to journalism school and film school and starting down the path of what might be considered more conventional, at least more people-oriented documentaries, that part of what you did is realize that what you needed to further do is align the interest that began when you were that kid coming home from school, running up into the tree with the lunch, and do what you did then as a filmmaker, as opposed to interviewing a politician or a corporate maven or whatever else you might have been doing in those first few years.
Yes, yes. No, I feel, I don't know, everybody kind of, I feel like you stumble into the career. You don't, it's never really a straight path, and I'm so grateful I stumbled into this one, because I really, there's just nothing like it, and it's exhausting. And it's hard and it's frustrating, so I don't want to paint a glory picture, because it's not necessarily easy, but all the good things that happen when, you know, an animal gives birth right in front of you or trusts you enough to approach you when you've been sitting there, you know, trying to just not be a threat in any way week after week and let it go about its business, and all of a sudden it looks up and it looks you in the eye and then it goes back to eating, you think, okay, you trust me, this is great, I'm
right.
in the world now.
That's why I'm doing this. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's so special. There's just constantly those kind of special reminders that this is, not many people get to do this. We're so lucky.
Well, we'll come back to some of how that manifests itself in Remarkable Rabbits in a moment or two. But I'd be curious to know that once you sort of had, I wouldn't say false starts, but once you started down one path of documentaries and then kind of veered back into your longtime love of nature and animals and other critters, tell me about some of your favorite films that you've made or otherwise worked on, either because the location or setting was meaningful, or the animals being spotlighted really spoke to you, or you had a personal connection of some kind, or maybe some combination of those factors.
Oh, so many. I think one of my favorites is a film that came out maybe about 10 years ago called A Murder of Crows. And I got the idea for it because I was sitting on my deck having a cup of coffee, and literally a fledgling crow just fell out of a tree right onto the deck and just kind of was shocked itself and looked up at me with these bright blue eyes, and we were both staring at each other quite amazed. And they can't fly when they fledge, so he, you know, was just looking at me, had nothing he could do. So we had a good long stare at each other before I moved inside so his mom could come and get him and move him off somewhere. And it made me realize, gosh, I don't know anything about crows. I didn't know they had blue eyes. I mean, I hear them every day, but what's the blue eye thing about? And I started doing research, and it led me down the path of what every film does. It usually starts with, oh my gosh, I didn't know that. And that led me down the path of working with scientists who discovered that crows can pick out individual people from large groups. And being in the on the campus in Washington of the University of Seattle with a scientist who was wearing a mask that looked like Dick Cheney, of all things, so not like anyone on the campus, and crows were dive bombing him and only him when there were hundreds of people all around him. And that was because he picked up its mother and put a band on its leg when it was when they were doing the start of their study to see if crows could actually individually identify people. So witnessing that, this crow recognized one guy, and then that crow passed it on to its young, and we were there to film when its young avoided that guy, which was the first time it had been known that that happened. We could offer proof of it because we were filming. That was really amazing. And another really special time was spending a year in the Rocky Mountains. We were to a film called A Year in the Life of a Twig Eater. We were filming moose calves as soon after they were born. We wanted to follow that first year of their life to document the relationship between the mother and the calf. And it's at a time now, this was about 5 years ago, and it's still where there's a lot of problems with moose populations and dwindling populations. And so we wanted to document, you know, if you can make it through the first year, your chances of survival are exponentially higher. So we wanted to document what happened in that first year. And that was when we started filming the calf and its mom when it was about 6 hours old, couldn't even walk. And you know, you have to keep your distance. You never want to be a threat, so you're never chasing anything. So you're literally just trying to be still in the environment. And she got to trust us so much. You know, she would just, we could be laying in the bush just because we didn't want to draw any attention to her. And we could be laying in the bush for hours, and she would just get up and walk over and graze like 4 feet from the camera.
Mm.
And watching that little calf grow up, oh, it was magical. I mean, how often in your life are you ever going to watch day after day of a calf growing up, a moose calf?
Well, for some of us, just even a fleeting moose sighting is pretty thrilling. So what you're describing here just sounds incredible.
It really was. We all felt so lucky, but it was so hard because moose are so built to travel through the forest. They have these long legs. They can go up and down banks. They can climb mountains. Try trying to follow a moose that's just walking in 5 foot deep snow up a mountain in the woods day after day after day. It was just exhausting.
No, that sounds like it. And just to go back for one sec, Susan, to the Murder of Crows film. So I just want to be clear. The guy in the Cheney mask was conducting a study of whether crows can identify someone and effectively sort of hold a grudge, basically, it sounds like.
Exactly. And identify a distinct-looking individual. So
right. So the guy doing that is the guy that was clearly identified by the crows and subsequent generations of crows as the guy who banded the mom, and so that was like proving the point in the most incredible manner possible, I guess.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's being there for that groundbreaking science, because one of the things I've learned over the years is that scientists often, they can't be in the field every day. And so I share a lot of our footage with the scientists that we're working with, and I can't tell you the amount of times they come back and say, oh my God, I'm going to write a paper on this. I had no idea this was happening. Because we're there filming, you know, when we're in it for the long haul, and we're in it all the way.
Yeah.
And so it's a really lovely relationship of working with scientists. It's a huge trust thing for them to trust us with their research.
Yeah.
And it's reciprocated. I mean, we trust them with what we're filming. And I really love the development of those relationships.
No doubt. No, it sounds like it's a great classic kind of symbiotic relationship when you're working on those kinds of things, and you can give people, those scientists must feel like it's the biggest holiday gift, like, oh my God, look at this footage that we otherwise would have no access to.
Yeah, and papers have been written based on it. On, you know, I know that there's scientists working on some of the, that analyzed the footage from the Moose film because they'd never seen it, and he's writing papers on that.
Yeah.
And papers came out of the Crow film. Like, it's a constant, you know, joining of forces.
That's great. Let me let folks know, this is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss, and my guest is Susan Fleming, a director who specializes in nature films, and whose latest documentary, Remarkable Rabbits, airs tonight as part of the PBS series Nature. This conversation was recorded Friday. I guess let's bring your filmography up to the present, even though I'd love to hear about some of the other ones you worked on, just given how fascinating those two were. But I can't help ask at this moment, why rabbits?
Yeah, well, over the years I've started to specialize in sort of more common wildlife, urban wildlife. I'm really fascinated by the animals we see around us, because I feel like there's all these hidden worlds. They're going about living in their world, and we're living in ours, and the two don't necessarily, you know, we don't know anything about theirs.
Yeah.
And so I'm really fascinated with urban wildlife. But the idea for the rabbit film came about because I live on a horse farm north of Toronto, and I have this huge guard dog you can probably hear barking in the background, a big Bouvier named Milo. And I travel a lot for my work, as you'd expect.
Sure.
And when I leave, a farm sitter comes and stays to take care of all the animals on the farm. And when she comes, she brings this little black and white poof of a rabbit called Pancakes that she takes everywhere with her. And this rabbit became best friends with my dog, this massive dog.
Wow.
My dog follows it around, literally to the point that if you open the fridge, they both come running and sit pretty, waiting for a treat. And if you put something out, the dog, the 100-pound dog, looks to the rabbit to say, can I have it? And inevitably, the rabbit does not let him have it, and he eats it first.
Wow, Pancakes in charge.
Pancakes in charge, which completely blew me away. I really didn't know anything about rabbits except, you know, that they eat my shrubs and drive me crazy sometimes. So his personality was so powerful, I started to do a little bit of research on rabbit, and what I learned really amazed me, because I didn't realize there were so many different kinds of wild rabbits, like everything from pygmy rabbits that live in the sagebrush and sagebrush steeps, like in Idaho, and they're scientifically proven to be the cutest rabbits on the planet, all the way to, let's say, New England cottontails, which have smaller eyes and are literally built to live in brush thickets, and European rabbits, and the diversity really surprised me, and how they're all kind of landscape specialists. They're custom built to exist in different landscapes. And the more I learned, just the more fascinated I got. And that's where the film comes from.
It's really striking because, first of all, of course, right off the bat, there's a fundamental addressing of the difference between rabbits and hares. But even beyond that, it's hard to imagine so many different kind of rabbits. And kind of like you say, they're almost like custom made for whatever part of the world they live in or what kind of habitat they need to survive, much less flourish in. And so,
and really specific habitats, like there's volcano rabbits that literally just make their home in volcano larvae. Some of them are really specific, and there's a few, like cottontails, eastern cottontails, which we see everywhere through North America, that can live anywhere. They're real generalists, but they're one of the few. Most rabbits are really built for specific landscapes and can only exist within those specific landscapes. Like, that's why 25%, over 25% of native rabbit species in their own habitat are on the brink of extinction, and which is something that really surprised me. You think there's rabbits everywhere, but no, there's only specific kinds of rabbits are doing well, and that's a small number of species. But native rabbits are, in fact, in trouble, and that's because their landscape is, you know, being destroyed because of humans moving in, but it's climate change. There's a whole host of factors. And we ended up doing filming with a bunch of different scientists that are doing tons of work to bring back native species like New England cottontails. All along the eastern seaboard in the U.S., there's a huge dedicated group of scientists working to bring back that species that at one point had less than 100 in the world. Or the pygmy rabbits, which are adorable, there was less than 6 in the world. And so we filmed with researchers, you know, doing work to bring that species back from the brink of extinction. Because I think one thing people see a rabbit and they don't really give it a second thought, but they're a keystone species in the ecosystems that you find them in. And those species, those systems can be everything from Canada's boreal forest to the Sonoran Desert. You know, they're food for so many other animals, and they spread seeds, and, you know, burrowing animals like the pygmy rabbits aerate soil. They're eco-engineers. They do so much good for the world, and we really need to keep these species around. They're really important.
It's really true, and a couple things. One is that some of us do not take rabbits for granted. I live in South Florida, and in late afternoon, early evening, I'll step out of my house for one reason or another, and with any luck, just to the right on the lawn there, there's at least one or two, I just call them bunnies, but I'm sure they are.
They're probably eastern cottontails.
Yeah, exactly. And few things make me happier than just seeing one or two of those just kind of hanging out and munching on some grass. And so there's that. But also back to the extinction thing, because, yeah, that's one of the many things I found really fascinating about your film is that when we talk about animals that are going extinct or at least at risk for doing so, most of us, even if we're pretty plugged into the animal world, don't think of rabbits as being part of that discussion. But clearly we should be. And as you talked about, the New England cottontail, the film offers really, I think, an intriguing glimpse of efforts at two zoos to help restore that population. And even that was interesting to me because in most cases when the zoo talks about its so-called conservation efforts or its breeding program to help restore an endangered species, many of us kind of dismiss that as baloney, that's just calling an altogether different agenda something kind of lofty. But in this case, it was real. It was legit. And
it's legit for a reason most people wouldn't really... Well, not, I don't want to phrase it that way, but it's legit in a way that surprised me, which was I always thought, you hear the expression breed like rabbits, that these guys can, you know, breed like bunnies and raise their numbers whenever they want. But in fact, it needs to be very specific conditions for rabbits to survive. And so the breeding programs are having, you know, they have to go to extreme extents to be able to create the environment and the conditions where the young will survive through that first month of life so that they can, you know, perhaps be, that then be let go and continue on and have a life in the wild. Like, it's intense work for these breeding programs. They've spent a lot of time and a tremendous amount of energy trying to learn the secrets of rabbit success in terms of survival because they're a precarious species. I hadn't realized how everything has to be right for the young to survive.
Yeah, and even as you show that once they've been in a form of a captive breeding program, then the next step really seems to be this kind of enclosed or semi-enclosed space where they can kind of get used to being in the wild, including like foraging for food, but also being aware of and mindful of predators. And then I guess from there, they're finally sprung all the way out into the wild. So it's really fascinating to just see that, again, this is what's being employed with rabbits when, again, most of us wouldn't have thought in those terms to begin with at all.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a noble effort, and you can't stress enough how important the effort is. These scientists are putting so much time and energy into it because they're a keystone species, because we don't really understand how it all works. And so when you know something's a keystone species and so many other animals are relying on it for their survival, it just becomes a kind of, a rolling blockchain that you need to be able to preserve whatever you can preserve. I mean, it's one of the fascinating things for me was the new science that we were able to film coming out of the Yukon with snowshoe hare. And it's one of the longest studied predator-prey relationships has been lynx and snowshoe hare. And we've always known that there's these big influxes where the numbers of hare and lynx goes up and then it drops off every 11 years or so and then it builds up. But one of the incredible things that a scientist named Rudy Boutineau has been discovering is that one of the driving factors for lynx and owls and so many predators in the Yukon survival in this up and down flow of life is the snowshoe hare. They're controlling the game. These incredible white powder puffs that are on everybody's dinner plate have a key role in deciding how many of every other species there are out there, in that they start to block their breeding. Instead of 4 litters a year, they'll have 2. When the predators get too much, they take on the task of dealing with them, and they're in the control seat. They have less young, they have them in less frequently, and so when their numbers drop off, then all of a sudden the food drops off, and so the lynx start dying off. And once that number starts to get to a place where it looks like, okay, the hare are going to be able to survive, they've knocked off a lot of their predators, they wait a few more years before they start going back to their normal breeding program, so that they really know they've knocked out the competition. And then they start to ramp up when the predators are at their lowest. The snowshoe hares start breeding like crazy, so that they can ensure their survival. And, I mean, that's groundbreaking science that is just coming out. And it's remarkable that the thing you would think is the most defenseless, you know, little animal on the snow is the one, you know, controlling the game.
Yeah. No, that's what's so fascinating about animals and learning about them is, just as you say, when you look at a snowshoe hare, and it's a striking animal. It's cool looking, and of course, but yeah, it looks like fairly meek, or hey, just kind of sweet and helpless or whatever. And the fact that it's like in charge and sort of running the whole operation is shocking in a way, but in a very cool way.
Yeah. You just realize the power of nature and all of this kind of master plan that we don't really know that much about, that we're, you know, we get little glimpses into. I mean, I just find that all fascinating.
For sure. And there's some other rabbits in particular that, before we run out of time, I want to address. But one of the things that we've talked about a few times, including with the program to restore the population of the New England cottontails and even the snowshoe hares, is just mating. And of course, as you noted, I mean, there's sort of the common perception that rabbits are prolific maters, but there's some pretty extraordinary footage of eastern cottontails mating that you include in the film that, I mean, I will be very careful from now on how I use the word cavorting. Let's just put it that way.
It is such an incredible dance. That's unbelievable. Right, and that was right in the heart of downtown Chicago in Maggie Daly Park. So we're like freeways all around us, tons of people. Then when the people drop off, you know, in the evening, the rabbits came out, and it was their world. And we were just there to document it. And there were so many. And this happens everywhere. And the mating ritual of jumping over each other, and it's ballet. It's unbelievable.
We just want people, of course, to see it for themselves. We won't give too much away, but it's a pretty amazing scene of what really goes on, almost regardless of the fact of where it's going on, although that makes it doubly extraordinary to me. But just the fact that how the males and the females interact and the sort of dance that they engage in, and some things that are pretty acrobatic even, I mean, it's something to see for sure. So,
and the fact is, it's probably happening in your backyard, in my backyard, you know, it's happening all around us, and that's kind of the beauty of urban wildlife, that these miraculous things are happening all around us, and if you stop and you really pay attention, you might be able to see it.
Yeah. Well, it makes me now think, like, hey, instead of just popping out and just being tickled to see the bunnies out on my lawn, maybe I should pull up a chair and see if we're going to see any acrobatics or other things that you capture here, because it's...
Again, I tell you, the month of April is the hot month for rabbits, so...
Okay. Well, with many of us kind of stuck to our houses, I'll probably have the time to conduct my own observation in that way. Again, this is Talking Animals on WNF. I'm Duncan Strauss, and my guest is Susan Fleming, a director who specializes in nature films, and whose latest documentary, Remarkable Rabbits, airs tonight as part of the PBS series Nature. This conversation was recorded Friday. So we don't run out of time to talk about a couple other things, including some other fairly extraordinary rabbits. Let's touch on the swamp rabbit.
Oh, aren't they amazing?
Oh, my gosh. Again, I want to be careful about spoilers, but just don't know that we could have a conversation about your film, Remarkable Rabbits, without at least touching on swamp rabbits. You want to talk a little bit about them, or?
Well, it was incredible, incredible to see them swim with their remarkable abilities. I mean, these are rabbits who are built to live, as, you know, we've talked about them being landscape specialists. These guys are built to live in floodplains and swamps, and they are the largest cottontail on the planet. And their size helps them with buoyancy, and they are amazing swimmers. They use waterways to swim to find mates, find food, evade predators. And what really, we were the first team to ever film them swimming in their natural environment. And it was not an easy get, man. We spent weeks and weeks tromping through the swamps of Missouri, fighting off hordes of mosquitoes and these wild pigs that scream in the evening and so many poisonous snakes. To get the footage. It was very hard won, but really worth it. I think it'll surprise the heck out of most people. It surprised me.
Yeah.
I couldn't believe how competent they were as swimmers, how easy it seemed. They you know, paddled. They were like bunny paddling, and it just seemed like completely natural to them.
Right.
And it was really incredible to see them and their ability, because they're different. All these rabbits are just slightly different from each other. If you really look, you start to say, wow, that one jumps like way different than the other ones. And so it was the uniqueness of how they move both on the land and in the water that surprised me. And I don't think, you know, anyone really has seen this before, so it's a really great get for
yeah.
the film.
No, it's pretty dazzling. And so was part of that challenge of Susan that they don't go into the water with any sort of predictable pattern, like not a certain time of day or not under a certain circumstance, so you guys would be set up there hoping to capture it, and for one reason or another it just wouldn't happen when you had kind of hoped or expected that
I
it might?
I think they go in the water whenever they feel like it. The challenge right. for us is was that they're super secretive.
Okay.
So they're just, they hide in downed logs. They spend their day hidden away. They're not like an eastern cottontail that will come out on your lawn.
Yeah.
These guys never want to be seen. There's a lot of predators in the environments they're in.
Sure.
So they spend all their time hidden. And because of swamps, it's just hard to move about any great distances, which, you know, if I was, you know, you're on the plains of Africa, you just travel till you find the animal you're looking for. Well, these guys could be in any log anywhere around you, and we had two camera teams, and we walked literally for weeks and weeks, and when you would find one, you know, they're really fast, so you just had to sit there and wait for it to decide to move.
Wow.
So, you know, you might find one every other day, and it might not move for 12 hours.
Oh, my goodness.
And you're watching the darkness come on thinking, please, please move, please move, because you know, the thing about nature filmmaking is it has to be natural behavior.
Yeah.
You don't have an animal running away from you. I mean, that's not a usable shot. So you really just have to sit in their environment and try to zen out and let them do what they want to do and be in the moment to be able to film it when it happens. So that was just an exercise in patience, because you're sitting there zenning out trying to just be in the moment. You got him in your long sights, you know, 300 feet away with a long lens, and you're just waiting as you're getting eaten alive by mosquitoes, as you're watching poisonous snakes, like, slither in the distance. And there's these ticks in where we were filming that are the Lone Star ticks. If they bite you, you don't ever eat red meat again. And I mean, I appreciate vegetarianism, but I do like myself a steak. And so we're all feeling them crawl up us. We were like chimps, because you always film in teams, and so that you can, you know, you have safety.
Yeah.
I would be picking them off the neck of my cameraman as quietly and like not trying to move as possible, so they didn't go into his hairline. And he's staying steady with his camera aimed at this rabbit, you know, 400 feet away, because if you move it, you're never going to find him again, because it took you days to find him. It was just an experience.
Yeah. Well, then even hats off more and gigantic kudos for the first footage, really, ever, of the swamp rabbit swimming. Anyway, we're in our final moments. This is Talking Animals on WNF. I'm Duncan Strauss, and I'm speaking with Susan Fleming, a director whose new film, Remarkable Rabbits, all about rabbits and hares, airs tonight as part of the PBS series Nature. This conversation was recorded Friday. So, but before we conclude any kind of conversation about Remarkable Rabbits, Susan, I feel it's almost incumbent on us to discuss the rabbit show. I mean, the Westminster Dog Show has nothing on this rabbit extravaganza, if you ask me. So, I mean, starting with the people, the judges, the breeders, certainly T. Eric Stewart, bow tie wearing colorful character who's an official with the American Rabbit Breeders Association. I mean, boy, it is, like I say, it gives the Westminster Dog Show a real run for the money, and you think, hey, Fred Willard and all that crew maybe should reassemble and take a stab at
great.
This. Yeah.
It is a world unto itself, and it's a big world. I mean, there's so many people involved in rabbit showing and that have pet rabbits. And are really dedicated to the cause. It was an entree into a world I didn't even know about. And we met so many amazing people. And I fell in love with lionhead rabbits who look literally like little lions. They're unbelievable. There's over 60 kinds of domestic rabbits. I think that's the number. There's just so many different kinds. And the characters are so strong.
Oh, my goodness.
I mean, can you imagine blow drying your rabbit for hours? And they have to do it every single day so the fur doesn't get matted.
No, that's the thing. But, I mean, the people were, again, fascinating and kind of more than a few eccentrics mixed in, of course. But I don't want to give short shrift to the rabbits because there were, at least at this show that you captured, there were 49 breeds of rabbits.
Oh, 49, that's the number. Yeah.
And I thought, oh, my God, this just kind of underscores what I've said a couple times in our conversation here that, again, most of us, even if we love animals and love rabbits, just wouldn't have any occasion to know that there's that many different kinds of rabbits. It's just astonishing.
Yeah, and they all look so dramatically different.
Yeah.
And I can't tell you, the people at that show were so nice to us. I mean, I'd been talking to them for months coming up to it, and everybody, you know, when people are passionate about what they do, those are the people you want to film. Like, they're full of life, and they really care about it, and they were amazing, and the rabbits were out of this world.
It's really, it was quite striking. And so, Susan, we're just going to wind it up here in a moment, but I just want to see if you can give me any kind of sneak preview of what your next film might be, if you know.
Well, unfortunately, with the whole COVID crisis, I don't.
Right.
It's very difficult. You can't, you know, fly anywhere. So my whole, the next project is really very up in the air. And
sure.
We'll see what happens with time. Everything in the world will return to normal.
Of course. Was there something specific that before the COVID-19 crisis hit that you were aiming for or had in mind?
I had a couple of projects on the drawing line, but it's now I feel like I can't discuss them because everything's so up in the air.
I gotcha. No problem. Well, yeah, let's hope for just any number of reasons that this virus disaster gets behind us quickly and everybody can go back to doing what they do, including making great films. So this has been Susan Fleming, and the film, once again, that is Remarkable Rabbits. It airs for the first time tonight on PBS, a show called Nature. And again, I think you can watch it subsequent times on the PBS.org/nature website. So even if you can't catch it tonight, but it's great viewing for if you're sheltering in place or in a home lockdown. That's another cool thing to watch. And if you aren't surprised by some things you see and learn about rabbits, I'll refund your money. So how about that?
And it'll make you smile in these troubling times. It'll make you smile.
Yeah, which is worth a lot these days for sure. So Susan, thank you so much for joining us today on Talking Animals and all your great work. And I know people are going to really enjoy checking out Remarkable Rabbits.
Thank you so much, Duncan.
Thank you.
And in the interest of keeping things moving, in an interview recorded Thursday, this is Rhonda Eldridge of Community Pet Project on Talking Animals on WMNF.
Thank you for having us.
So let's dive right in. What prompted you to start the Community Pet Project?
Actually, I didn't personally start it. It was started in June of 2017 as a division of a local rescue. About 11 months later, the need had fully blown up and the rescue could no longer support us. So in June of 2018, we became a standalone 501c3 nonprofit servicing Hillsborough County. So we're coming up almost on our 2-year anniversary here shortly.
Well, that's great. In advance, happy anniversary. So when you say that you couldn't sustain it, does that mean the demand was so intense for what the Community Pet Project was doing as an offshoot of that rescue that there was just no way to sustain it and you guys needed to kind of create your own separate entity to keep it going properly? Is that the...
Exactly. That's exactly. Correct. Yeah.
Okay. So backing up to the beginnings just for a sec, was there a certain story or incident that spurred the creation of the Community Pet Project, or was it more just the cumulative product of maybe several stories? What was the impetus, in other words, to get it launched?
Okay. Well, in Hillsborough County, the Sheriff's Department, Tampa Police Department, and Temple Terrace Police Department hold quarterly outreach events throughout Hillsborough County at different locations each quarter. One of the officers from TPD that spearhead this happens to live next door to a dog trainer and had approached her one time and said, hey, we think that there's a need for you guys at these outreaches because a lot of homeless people have pets. So she reached out to the local rescue and were like, sure, you know, I belong to that rescue. It's like, sure, okay, we'll go. And you can't even put words on that first event. We were underprepared. It was incredible, the need for these services. So we have attended every outreach that has not been canceled since June of 2018.
And how often?
Sorry to interrupt, Ron.
I was just going to ask, how often are those outreach events held?
Quarterly. Four times a year, every 3 months.
I got you. And it sounds like now and again, from what you said as an aside there, that for some reason, occasionally they are canceled, but typically they are...
I mean, the Hurricane Irma canceled one.
Yeah. So extraordinary circumstances. Otherwise, quarterly, pretty much without fail, they would happen.
Yeah.
And you guys started to be there at everyone.
We do, yes, sir.
Yeah. So once you saw what the need was, it was like, wow, okay, we didn't quite anticipate this great of a need, but somebody's got to help out with it, right?
Yeah, it was kind of funny. I was just telling a volunteer that came to the other day. I said, because I have a Jeep Cherokee, I said originally we were able to transport everything in the back of my Jeep Cherokee. About 6 months later, we ended up having to get a trailer to tow behind us, all of the stuff that we needed. And now in the last year, we've had to rent a 9-foot cargo van from U-Haul to transport everything that we take to the outreaches.
Wow. Well, I was going to ask at some point how the organization might have changed since its inception. And that's a pretty good visual for the key changes. So it just sounds like there's more and more food and things being distributed and bigger vehicles required to help.
And there's more donations. We survive totally on donations and fundraisers. We don't receive any funding, state, local, or federal. So everything that we have is donated or purchased through donations. So as we get more people donating stuff to us, then obviously we have more that we can take to the outreaches, which also requires the larger vehicle to transport.
Sure. Well, I was going to ask you towards the end, but this is as good a time as any. If someone just already hearing what they've heard and they'll hear more about what you guys do to help various folks that for one reason or another might be struggling a little bit to keep their pets fed, what would people do? How would they go about either donating money, which of course is always a good thing, and or food? What steps would they take to help support the community pet project?
Well, we have a couple of options. Of course, we have our PayPal, which you can donate through PayPal. You can mail us donations to our post office box.
So I guess we should say that, first of all, there is a website that's communitypetproject.org, so you could always go there for information. And then
and our Facebook page. You can also donate from the Facebook page.
Okay, great. So there's a couple different two or three options right there to donate. So, but if you're not doing necessarily strictly monetary donations, let's say one reason or another you ended up with a big extra bag of dog food that month for whatever set of circumstances, I'm guessing you guys are open to direct donations of pet food as well as financial donations.
Correct. And not just food, but any pet-related item.
Okay.
And we can either arrange pickup anywhere in Hillsborough County, or we can actually have it delivered to our warehouse.
That's great.
And let me just add, we also take broken bags. So let's say you bought a bag of food for your dog and he won't eat it.
Oh,
we will take broken bags.
Okay, great.
Because we break them down into smaller Ziploc bags.
Oh, I see.
And so we can take broken bags.
Right, so nothing goes to waste. Yeah.
We honestly waste nothing.
No, that's great. And is there, on the other hand, having said that though, is there any like limitation of either type of food or maybe even certain brands or anything else that for one reason or another you tend to shy away from, or is any and all pet food fair game?
Any and all is fair game. The one thing that we kind of steer away from, but we do find alternate places to donate it, is prescription food. Because we don't want to hand out prescription food if it's for one, you know, one illness or one medical issue and give it to the wrong pet. So when we do get prescription food donated, we either ask rescues if they have certain pets on that food, or we can donate to a food pantry that is in a clinic that can actually disperse it properly.
Right. So again, even there, if you end up with something like that, even if it might not go out through the normal community pet project channels, it'll still get used somewhere, somehow.
Correct.
Most effectively.
Correct.
That's great. So how many families or individuals would you say you help in a given week?
That's kind of a tricky question.
Okay, well, you can answer it. Any, you can answer it in a different way, whatever. I'm just trying to get a sense of numbers and scope here.
Sure.
I guess. Yeah.
Our mission statement states that we help the pets of the homeless and the at-risk in Hillsborough County by providing the basic needs to the pet, which includes food, treats, collars, leashes, flea preventative, grooming supplies, crates, beds, medical referrals, and medical co-pays when we have the funding available.
Wow.
Because of COVID-19 and this national crisis that we're in, we've opened it up to anybody with a need. So you no longer have to meet the qualifications of our normal services to get food from us. If you do need other things from us, we will ask you to fill out an intake form. But if you're just stating that you have loss of income or decreased income or medical issues, or, you know, your doctor's telling you you can't go out, you can't go shopping, those are the people that we're helping right now. So I can tell you, in the past 2 weeks, we have helped 28 families, 67 dogs, 29 cats, and one ferret with food in Hillsborough County, with enough food to get them through a month so that we don't have to, you know, expose them or expose ourselves any more than we need to.
Right. So is that one of the things that's also changed in the wake of the COVID-19 crisis?
That has been the one change in the wake of COVID, yes, sir.
Yeah, so a larger quantity of food to keep people going for a longer period of time, so there's just
correct.
Less need
yes.
for contact, obviously, yeah. So I'm interested in hearing about your routine. That's a lot of folks to be helped in a given period. Can you kind of take me through, to the extent even a typical day exists, or these days probably it doesn't, but when you're making the rounds, give me a sense of what that day would look like if you're out delivering, you know, food and other beds and
right.
and treats and whatever else. Yeah,
this is all new to us.
Okay.
And actually, an organization like ours is new to this area. So every day is different for us because there is no normal day.
Sure.
And with the rescue, there's no normal day in the rescue
of
as
course.
Well.
Yeah.
But and the needs and change daily, and the clients change daily. Everything changes daily.
Yeah.
But as far as the COVID-19 clients, we take the request through either phone calls, phone messages, Facebook messaging, Facebook posts, or emails. So we have 5 different media means that we have to monitor to see all of the requests.
Mm-hmm.
And then we simply plug those addresses into Google Maps, and then we plot the route. If the route is too big, then we divide the route up for a couple of different delivery drivers, and which are all our volunteers. And then we usually try to keep it to just a couple of hours, because we don't want our people out there any more than we have to.
Sure.
But we maintain the 6-foot. We don't even see the client. Usually, I told one client, it used to be that our requirement was we had to get puppy kisses when we left. But right now, we have to forego that to maintain the 6-foot distance. So
sure.
We ask that the client stay in their home. We text them when we're there. We text them that we dropped it off. And then we leave, and then they can come out and get the stuff. So they're protected, we're protected, and we're adhering to the ordinances put in place right now.
Right. Wow. That's super impressive. How many volunteers does Community Pet Project have at the moment?
I think we have 63. Of course, all of them have different participation levels. They're not, some are overly active, some are not as active.
Sure.
But I think we have 63 on our volunteer page.
That's great.
And we're getting more requests now. People are seeing us. They saw us on the news the other day. They're reaching out to us. Some of them are not working right now, and they just want to be productive and do something.
Yeah.
But they don't want to be full-time volunteers, but they want to help through this crisis.
That's
you
great.
Know? So I actually have a volunteer going to Dunedin today to pick up some donations because she saw us on the news.
Oh, that's
so
great.
Yeah.
So one of the distinctive traits of the Community Pet Project is that it has a very specific focus in serving folks who live in Hillsborough County. Is that focus because you saw a particular need there as an outgrowth of the rescue, how this was originally born at the beginning, or do you live in Hillsborough County? I'm just curious how that focus, which is specific geographically.
The rescue is in Hillsborough County.
Yeah.
I would say all of our volunteers live in Hillsborough County.
Okay.
And Hillsborough County, I think, is the 3rd largest county in Florida, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, no, it's...
So
yeah.
It's
go ahead, sorry.
It's very large,
right.
And it's heavily populated.
Yeah.
And there is a lot of need. I can tell you that since June of 2017, the first year we weren't covering any medical. In June of 2018 to December of 2019, the month of 2000, the year of 2019 was the first year that we actually started being able to cover for medical bills. We paid $500 per pet per year. And in 2019, we paid just over $10,000 in medical bills.
Wow.
So the need is there. And that's anywhere from, we promote spay neuter. So a lot of our clients are eligible for the Hillsborough County spay neuter voucher, which you can get your animal altered for $10, which includes a rabies shot. And they can't even afford that $10. So we'll cover the $10.
That
$10,000 that we spent can either be from a $10 copay, it could be annual vaccinations, or we've done, I think, 3 emergency surgeries that we've helped cover.
Yeah.
If the bill comes in more than $500, which the emergency ones do, then we reach out to our Facebook friends and we do a Facebook fundraiser, and we have never not received the additional funds that we've needed to cover a bill.
That's great. What an extraordinary network, obviously, that you have created.
Our supporters are incredible. Absolutely incredible.
Yeah, so let me let folks know who are maybe just catching this interview partway through. This is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss, and my guest is Rhonda Eldridge, president of the Community Pet Project, which provides pet food and other items to homeless and at-risk communities in Hillsborough County, and has stepped up its efforts in the wake of the expanding impact of the coronavirus pandemic. This conversation was recorded Thursday. So that's really great, Rhonda. It really sounds like whatever people need, and again, as you say, the needs have grown probably exponentially in the wake of the pandemic. It sounds like you guys are really able to help, and even if there's a sizable vet bill staring somebody in the face, it sounds like, if not immediately, within fairly short order, that can be sort of helped dispense with as well through Community Pet Projects. So that's got to be such a huge relief to people who are struggling in various ways. And so many people, of course, their businesses are temporarily, hopefully, but in some cases more than temporarily, shuttered, and people are out of work. So just the pressure and stress of keeping their pets not only fed, but also if there's a medical issue, that usually is a pretty frightening impasse for people. So it's just great to know that you guys can step up and help with that. So that's really, really great. So when you're not scrambling around working on community pet project tasks of all different kinds, what else do you do, or do you have any time that's not strictly devoted now to community pet project?
I do work. I have a full-time job.
Okay.
So
So you're juggling all the community pet project things and coordinating, it sounds like, racing around and delivering.
I have an incredible team of volunteers, and our board members are top-notch board members.
Yeah.
So I have a huge support group. It is no means anything that I am doing. It's always we. It's what we are doing as the nonprofit, what we are doing as the community. We couldn't do any of this without the support of our community.
Yeah.
We couldn't do any of this without the support of our volunteers. So we are beyond blessed to have the community and to have the people that we need to make a difference in our community.
Well, that's great. And Rhonda, we've spoken a good deal longer than we originally had in mind, but I think the time is well worth it. So this is Rhonda Eldridge. It's the Community Pet Project. The website is communitypetproject.org. You can also find them on Facebook. And so there's any number of ways people can get involved and help out and donate or their time, including volunteering. If now people have a little more time, they can help out and still maintain the restrictions of the various stay-at-home orders, etc. So Rhonda, thank you so much for joining us on Talking Animals and all your great work helping out all these folks, keeping their pets fed and healthy. That's very, very great. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for your time.
My thanks to Rhonda, Community Pet Project. We just about reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa. Rob Lori is up next. My huge thanks to Lee Courtney Flea for all the in-studio help and other production assistance this morning. Next Wednesday, anybody to return with my guest will be Jane Velez Mitchell, the award-winning journalist and former host of programs on CNN and HLN, now hosting a vegan cooking show on Amazon Prime called New Day, New Chef. We'll catch up with you next Wednesday at 10 a.m. on Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa. Thanks.